Today is June 12, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover Russia's accelerating fiscal collapse and what a roughly 60-day reserve runway means for frontline cohesion, Ukraine's systematic logistical strangulation of Crimea and its escalating deep strike doctrine, and why India has completed only 2 of 30 tracked benchmark reforms 2 years into Modi's third term. Russia has approximately 60 days of liquid reserves left at current burn rates. That is not a projection from a hostile think tank. It is the arithmetic produced by Dr. Jason Smart's analysis of Russia's own federal fiscal data for the first 5 months of 2026. Oil and gas revenues fell approximately 30% year-on-year from January through May, while federal spending rose 17%, generating an official five-month deficit of roughly $83.5 billion. Against an estimated $48 billion in liquid reserves held in Russia's National Wealth Fund, the depletion horizon is approximately 60 days absent new revenue or dramatic expenditure cuts. The full-year budgeted deficit target has already been overshot by 159%. German intelligence estimates cited by Dr. Smart place the annualized deficit closer to $283 billion, based on the first 5 months alone. The strategic calculus here is that no single policy instrument available to the Kremlin can resolve this simultaneously on all axes. Monetizing the deficit to maintain military pay devalues soldier salaries in real terms through inflation, which risks frontline cohesion degradation. Sustaining high interest rates to contain inflation continues the industrial strangulation that produced a 26% decline in corporate profits in the first quarter of 2026. And seizing private or foreign currency assets risks triggering capital flight and elite defection from Putin's patronage network. Russia cannot issue sovereign debt in accessible international markets. That option was foreclosed by the sanctions architecture, which transforms what would be a manageable fiscal stress for a creditworthy state into a structurally threatening constraint. Building on that, the corporate sector data is arguably more alarming than the sovereign picture. Total unpaid intercompany obligations in Russia now stand at approximately $651 billion, nearly 8 times the official 5-month federal deficit. Investment declined 14.3% in the first quarter of 2026, the steepest contraction since the 2009 global financial crisis. Investment goods output ran 16% below 2024 levels. Debt service is consuming $1 of every 3 in major industrial firms. Cash earnings. Dr. Smart reports retail depositors withdrew approximately $20 billion from Russian banks in January 2026 alone, with approximately $5.8 billion not returning to the banking system. A household confidence breakdown that, if sustained, approaches the cascading defaults that a Kremlin-adjacent think tank reportedly assessed as carrying high probability within 12 months of November 2025. There is one diagnostic data point that is particularly striking in Dr. Smart's analysis. Arkady Rotenberg's construction firms, among the most privileged nodes in Putin's entire patronage network, are reportedly delivering only about 60% of expected wage payments to up to 20,000 workers. When state contract revenue fails to reach even the most favored recipients in the system, it signals that the fiscal transfer mechanism itself is experiencing cascade failure, not merely peripheral squeeze. That is a qualitatively different condition than fiscal tightness. The fiscal deterioration does not exist in isolation. It is being actively accelerated by Ukrainian kinetic pressure, and that pressure is intensifying systematically. On June 9, 2026, President Zelensky publicly stated Ukraine's target of 600 long-range drones and missiles per day. On the same date, Commander-in-Chief Syrsky unveiled a long-term development concept for Ukraine's rocket forces and artillery, targeting serial production of cruise and ballistic missiles with 2,000-kilometer range by 2030. Ukraine has extended its deep strike reach approximately 2.5 times from a 630-kilometer baseline in 2022 to strikes now exceeding 1,750 kilometers, enabling operations against targets in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and energy export infrastructure. The shifting geography of power here is visible in what has happened to Crimea's supply lines in approximately 16 to 17 days preceding this analysis. Ukrainian drone operations systematically destroyed the bridges, serving both the M-17 and M-18 highway and rail access corridors into northern Crimea. The Novorossiya Highway, the 480-mile Sea of Azov circumnavigation route that had replaced the operationally degraded Kerch Bridge as Crimea's primary land artery, has been blanketed with strikes reportedly destroying hundreds of Russian military vehicles. Kerch Bridge rail throughput has declined approximately 80% from accumulated prior strikes. As of the analysis date, there is no functioning overland supply route into Crimea from the north. Sevastopol's civic administration announced suspension of gasoline rationing due to zero fuel deliveries. Civilian vehicle queues exceeding 600 cars have formed at Kerch Bridge crossing points. The strategic calculus here is a feedback loop that compounds on itself. Diesel fuel shortages directly degrade air defense radar and missile actuator electronics. That degraded air defense enables further Ukrainian strike effectiveness. Further strikes generate additional revenue denial pressure on hydrocarbon infrastructure. That denial pressure accelerates the fiscal deterioration we just examined. Each variable tightens the others. The Novorossiya Highway is not just a Crimea logistics route. According to Jason J. Smart's analysis, it is the primary supply artery for all Russian occupation forces west of Mariupol and south of the Dnipro River, the entire Kherson Oblast operational zone. Russian forces on the Kinburn Spit are assessed as already conducting retrograde maneuvers, driven by logistical collapse rather than Ukrainian ground pressure. The parallel Mariupol port strike, destroying the port control tower, all electrical substations, radar installations, and command nodes in broad daylight without effective air defense response, signals that Russia's air defense inventory has been depleted to the point where it cannot be allocated to military critical infrastructure outside Moscow's immediate security perimeter. More importantly, Ukraine's funding architecture for this campaign has been deliberately diversified. The $20 billion NATO investment request formally submitted by Deputy Defense Minister Banik on June 4th, actually $60 billion, is framed explicitly as a NATO collective defense asset rather than bilateral assistance, calibrated to European members increasingly focused on autonomous defense capacity independent of variable U.S. security commitments. Three Gulf states signed decade-long defense agreements with Ukraine following Operation Epic Fury, specifically citing interest in Ukraine's drone expertise. Firepoint co-founder Denis Stielerman stated his company alone builds approximately 200 long-range drones per day and can double or triple that with adequate funding. The gap between Ukraine's theoretical and actual production capacity is the most policy-actionable number in this entire briefing. Ukraine's FPV drone industry has a theoretical annual capacity of approximately 10 million units, yet actual 2025 production reached approximately 3 million, a 65 to 70% underutilization, driven by funding constraints, not industrial capability. The primary constraint on Ukraine's strategic scaling is capital. That is a variable directly addressable by NATO commitment decisions in the next 7 to 14 days. To understand why Moscow's response to all of this has been so structurally constrained, you need to understand what Dr. Nina Khrushcheva describes as the information environment surrounding Vladimir Putin himself. Khrushcheva, speaking at CSIS's Russian Roulette series, draws a direct parallel between Putin's current situation and a specific historical detail. When Nikita Khrushchev entered Stalin's dacha office after Stalin's death, he found it filled with unopened red folder urgent dispatches, critical intelligence that had arrived but was never read, because the structural incentives of the system precluded accurate upward reporting. Khrushcheva argues Putin is operating in a functionally equivalent information environment. Decisions that appear strategically irrational from outside may reflect genuinely distorted inputs rather than deliberate brinkmanship. Jason J. Smart's analysis separately corroborates this, assessing that Putin is negotiating on the basis of maps showing Russian territorial control that does not correspond to battlefield reality. Khrushcheva maps Russian society through four psychological phases since February 2022: initial disbelief and open discourse, fear consolidation through 2023. A what she calls screw you emotional register emerging in summer 2024, following events including the suicide of former Kursk governor Mikhail Starovoyt and WhatsApp call blocking, and the current phase she terms the Gulag emotional form, not terror-driven silence, but disengagement from political discourse because discourse feels pointless. Polling data shows frustration accumulating within Russian society with the war, but Khrushcheva explicitly cautions that frustration does not translate into actionable political pressure. Her assessed best-case succession scenario is not a liberal reformer. She calls it a Beria moment, a security apparatus insider who begins dismantling the most extreme repressive infrastructure for functional rather than ideological reasons. Virtually everyone in the current Russian political constellation, in her assessment, would produce what she describes as China today. Authoritarian structures under new management, not transformation. Planning scenarios premised on democratic liberalization after Putin are assessed as low probability. The Afghanistan on steroids trajectory she projects suggests that even a best-case successor would inherit an economy characterized by military-industrial dominance, structural debt, demographic hemorrhage, and no credible diversification pathway. Shifting to the Indo-Pacific, and specifically to an economy that represents the strategic alternative, many Western policymakers are counting on. India's reform trajectory at the two-year mark of Modi's third term presents a more complicated picture than the headline growth numbers suggest. CSIS's proprietary reform tracker monitors 30 benchmark reforms focused on economic growth and job creation. After 2 years of Modi 3.0, the government has completed 2 of 30 tracked reforms, a pace behind both the first and second terms. Former principal economic advisor Dr. Ila Padnaik identifies India's current approximately 6.5% GDP growth as largely a function of factor accumulation rather than total factor productivity growth. Breaking above this trajectory toward the 7-8% sustained growth required for the Viksit Bharat 2047 convergence target requires corporate bond market deepening, judicial efficiency, labor market flexibility, and urban governance devolution, all structurally incomplete. The most analytically significant countersignal within the government's own narrative is the expansion of quality control orders from approximately 88 in deployment in 2019 to approximately 765 at present. Dr. Bhuvna Anand characterizes this as industrial licensing through the back door. Protectionist instincts finding expression through regulatory rather than tariff mechanisms at precisely the moment New Delhi is marketing itself as a trade integration partner. This creates a credibility gap in India-US free trade agreement negotiations that CSIS program director Rick Rosso describes as perpetually characterized as imminent. The missing middle problem compounds this. Padnaik identifies a bimodal firm-size distribution, very small firms and large conglomerates with an absent middle tier, as a structural constraint on scaling enterprises. This traces directly to bank-dominated credit allocation favoring large corporates and the absence of a functional corporate bond market. The firm-size distribution that produces global manufacturing competitiveness requires precisely the scaling enterprises India currently lacks. For New Delhi's ambitions as a China plus one supply chain alternative, this is a foundational structural problem. There is also a near-term vulnerability worth flagging. The RBI operates under structural tension between its formal inflation targeting mandate and de facto exchange rate management, a vulnerability Padnaik explicitly characterizes as reminiscent of conditions 15 years ago, invoking the 2013 taper tantrum when India was identified as one of the fragile five. With US CPI running around 4%, any Federal Reserve rate response would pressure the rupee through debt market outflows. India's capacity to simultaneously defend the currency and maintain accommodative domestic rates would be severely tested, consuming political bandwidth that would otherwise support the reform agenda. In the next 48 hours, the single signal with the highest immediate leverage on the trajectories we have examined today is Elvira Nabiullina's status within Russia's monetary policy apparatus. Nabiullina is the central bank governor and the single technocratic anchor that has preserved Russia's monetary credibility under the most heavily sanctioned economy in modern history. Dr. Smart and Jason J. Smart both flag her reported impending displacement from key economic councils as a leading indicator of politically motivated interest rate cuts ahead of September parliamentary elections. If formally confirmed, her removal would telegraph the inflationary acceleration scenario, real military wages eroding, frontline payment reliability degrading, that historically precedes the kind of frontline cohesion failures that transform battlefield attrition into institutional collapse. Watch for any formal announcement from the Kremlin regarding economic council composition. That is the canary. Stay vigilant. Until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.